The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And today I'd like to welcome back to the program one of my favorite guests on the planet, Julie Clam. Hello, Julie.
Hello, Vic. One of my favorite interviewers on the planet.
Well, I don't have a TV show, Julie. I know you've been on some pretty big TV shows recently,
yeah.
but you know, we do the best we can out here.
Well, I didn't have to get my hair done for this phone call. I mean, for this interview, so I'm very happy about that.
Weren't you on what show were you on the other day?
I was on the Tonight Show.
That's it.
Yeah.
Wow. Were you nervous?
You know, the weeks before it, I was like projectile vomitingly nervous, and then the closer it got to it, I sort of went into this zone, and by the time I was there, I felt like I can do this. And I actually had the most fun doing it. As you know, good interviewers make people look good. And he wants people to have fun and not be scared. And so he made it very comfortable. And I had a fabulous time. I wish I was a talk show guest instead of a writer.
Well, I would think that would have been old hat to you. Didn't you used to work for David Letterman?
I did, and I had even been on the show when I worked for Dave, but in like silly skits and, you know, costumes and things like that. I was certainly never a guest in a chair there. And, you know, it's a completely insane experience because the book that I wrote is about celebrities. They sent a car to pick me up, which, you know, happens from time to time, but the driver was walkie-talkieing with whatever home base about where traffic was. He was going to take a different route. He was coming down. We were almost there. We're about to be there. Then this, you know, person with a clipboard runs over and sweeps me out of the car as if I am Madonna, and takes me into the building, escorts me to the next person who escorts me upstairs. I have two dressing rooms filled with all kinds of fabulous food, my name on the door, and the whole thing was like, oh, so this really is what being a celebrity is like.
Wow.
And then after that, I had to do a reading at one of my favorite bookstores, Word Bookstore in Jersey City, where I think three people came, and two of them were people I knew, and I was back right back to real life again.
Wow, that was quick.
Well,
I guess we better mention
the Tonight Show. I'm not going to have any plans after, so I can go over to the top of the rock and have martinis or something.
Well, I guess we better mention you do have a new book out, and I've been waiting for a long time for this book to come out, Julie, and it's finally here. It's called The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. Why did you write this, Julie? What was the inspiration?
What happened was, and the reason you had to wait so long was because I was going through a divorce. My kid was having a lot of issues, and I could not focus on anything. And I really didn't want to write about myself. The first four books were very much about me. And I needed, I've been working with Riverhead Books. This is my fifth. I have my sixth book with them that I'm writing now. And they're like a family. And my publisher knew I was sort of in a bind I was moving out and with my daughter, and it was a lot of, you know, things, and I needed to sell, I needed to do a contract, you know, as soon as I turned in my last book. Mm. And he said, you know, just I'll start the contract, and by the time we get it finished, you come up with a topic. I mean, it wasn't like I could come up with any topic and he was going to approve it, because there were, over the years, ideas I had that he said no. So anyway, every time I sat down at my computer to sort of think about what was something I could do that I would want to work on, that I would want to write about, I found myself being distracted by, you know, Charlie Sheen trending on Twitter. And I don't care at all about Charlie Sheen, but I clicked on it and read the story, and then, like, what happened to his ex-wife, Denise Richards? What is she doing? Oh, she was with Richie Sambora. He was with Heather Locklear. What happened between Richie Sambora and John Bon Jovi? Hours have gone. I have gone down several celebrities that I don't even care about rabbit holes, and it's time to make dinner. And so it was like a few weeks, and I was running out of time, and I was about to say, just, you know, stop it, stop the contract, because I can't think of anything. And then, you know, I was back reading something about celebrities, and there was sort of like a light bulb that went over my head, and I was thinking, what's that about? You know, for my whole life, I have always used celebrities as a distraction, and somehow makes me feel better about whatever thing I'm suffering with. Either they're going through something worse, or they're doing something fabulously, and I think, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I had a trainer and a hairstylist and, you know, enough money for, you know, a limo or whatever thing. And so I, before I sort of gave it to him, I did a little research to see if there were any sort of scientific possible reasons of why we are interested in celebrities. Because if it was just about, you know, my own thoughts, it might be fun, but it wouldn't be very substantive. So I started reading and seeing that there was, in fact, some science, and that researchers, scientists had done research on various things and had actually found some profound bits. And so so that's how I ended up there.
And here we are.
And here we are today.
With the stars in our eyes and Julie Clam. And you know, I interviewed your brother. You know, I interviewed your brother,
yes,
Matthew,
love
this
that
summer. And he finally put out another book. And I had asked you prior to that interview to give me some dirt on your brother.
Mm-hmm.
And you
yeah
did, and you did, and I didn't mention it. I didn't mention the dirt to him because I'm a nice boy.
You know, the thing about Matthew is that there's nothing horrible that he's ever done in his life that he wouldn't be more than happy to tell you about himself. The man has no filter.
Okay.
So you would have, it would have been fine. But yes, you are a gentleman.
Well, I asked him for dirt about you too. Am I still a gentleman?
It depends on what he said.
How come you didn't mention the guy from Squeeze in your book? Did I miss that?
That I had crushes on them?
Yeah.
I didn't mention it. I couldn't mention everybody.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there.
All right.
I mean, it would have been I could have had an entire book that would just list all the people I had crushes on.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I was in the Squeeze fan club, and I was. I went to see them. I went when Christopher and Glenn Tilbrook left Squeeze and had like a little duo act for a while. They performed 4 days in New York, and they went on. It was like a club that didn't have seats. You just went and everybody jammed together.
Mm-hmm.
And they went on at like 11 o'clock at night, and I got to the place at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to be the first one online so that I could be at the front of the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds like the Bowery Ballroom or someplace like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, it was.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess one of those guys has a new book out, so you'll probably be reading that. This is the Book Nook on WYSO. The Book Nook comes your way every Saturday morning at 7 o'clock and on Sundays at 10:30 in the morning. The Book Nook will continue with Julie Clam right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes, and today my guest on the program is Julie Clam. Her book is The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. Let's talk about how you set up this book, because you're not name-dropping, but it is a book about celebrities, and there were so many celebrities in this book, and some of them are real celebrities, like the Kardashians, and some of them are faux celebrities, like, I'm not even going to go there, but you did not give a whole lot of ink, though, to someone who is a former reality TV star who's probably the biggest celebrity on the planet right now. You didn't give this guy much ink right now. He's presiding over probably the most interesting reality in the world.
And that was intentional. You know, when I was writing the book, I finished and turned in this book in April of 2016.
Oh.
And we were talking about him, and I said, you know, I have a feel I'm going to mention him, but I have a feeling that by the time the book comes out, people aren't even going to remember him.
Mm-hmm.
And my editor was like, yeah, that's true. Well, just say something. I mean, people will remember he ran for president. So I did end up going in, and it was actually after I recorded the audiobook, and I thought, oh, my God, there's a glaring omission at this point. And so I wrote a small thing and put it and we got it into the book.
Okay.
But honestly, I've talked about it a lot in interviews that, you know, there are so many people who say, there are the people that you tell this, that you wrote this book about, and they say, oh, God, I can't wait to read that. I'm such a fan of blah, blah, blah. And then there are other people who say, oh, I hate that. I hate celebrities. I'm so not interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, we have a reality show star for a president, so it behooves us all to figure out how we got there. And, you know, you don't have to read my book, but it might give you a little clue as to how this happened.
I know. I like the fact that you don't really get the Kardashians either. I was a little concerned.
No, I did a little about the Kardashians. In that.
Right. But you don't get it.
No, I don't. I don't get it. I appreciate that they're very good business people.
Uh-huh.
And that's about it.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of these celebrities and the way you set it up. I like the fact that at the end of each chapter, you have first-person encounters with celebrities. That was really amusing.
Yeah, well, that came about because every time I would tell somebody that I was writing this book, they would say, oh, I have this great story to tell you. You know, my boyfriend and I were walking in the village, and this guy... Well, you know, and I dropped my phone down a drain, and this guy comes to help, and it's Philip Seymour Hoffman or, you know, Bruce Springsteen. Like, what was interesting to me was that people had stories that were 30 or 40 years old, and they couldn't tell me anything about that part of their lives, you know, who their teacher was in fourth grade, but they remembered the look and the color of the car that Paul Newman was putting gas into and the expression he had on his face and what the guy said. So these events take on this real poignancy in people's lives, and they remember it. They sort of shine with it.
Yeah.
I do know the writer Courtney Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
She and I were walking in the Women's March in New York together, and I had to be here. I couldn't go to D.C. because I had to be here for something for my kid, and Courtney was 5 months pregnant or 6 months pregnant and not really up for the travel. So we decided to march together in New York, and we were marching, and we were both complaining a lot about how tired we were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of standing when you march. And then I sort of said, you know, maybe we are overdoing it because there are people who have, like, marched in, like, very dangerous ways, and there's a Pan Quotidien, like, 2 feet away from us. And then we looked, and Sigourney Weaver was right in front of us marching, and it was like somebody gave us both an injection of caffeine. We were energetic, and, oh, my God, Sigourney Weaver, okay, we can march from here to, you know, Alabama. So, you know, there are all of these stories about, you know, the little celebrity incidences that we had. And I also gave, you know, feel like people get different ratings for the celebrities they see. If you like when I was on The Tonight Show, the celebrities I saw there, that does not count because they're sort of in captivity. If you see them in the wild, you know, that is a lot. Those are a lot of points.
Okay.
You know, you see Harvey Keitel in the hardware store, you know, that's big.
Well, when you're in Manhattan, I imagine you have a lot more opportunities to just randomly see people like that out in public.
And, for sure, you do.
Don't you kind of play it cool, though? I mean, isn't that sort of expected?
It is. Everybody plays it cool. Occasionally, somebody will see somebody that is so important to them that they feel like they have to say something. But for the most part, you know, you're not seeing Madonna.
Mm.
You know, you see Arliss Howard and Deborah Winger or Samantha Bee or, you know, people that are sort of less, you know, mind-blowing, but still, you know, significant people.
Yeah.
So, I always sort of think if they're very famous, I try not to look at them and I just keep going. If they're up and coming or they're formerly famous, then I give them a look because I think it makes them feel better to be recognized.
Well, I'm a kid from Iowa, so I just stand there with my mouth wide open, and I couldn't speak anyway because I'm just so in awe. It's just so amazed. But I have occasionally broken down. And one time I went to Omaha because I was supposed to be a bodyguard for Patti Smith at a at a signing at a record store. But that wasn't the high point. The high point for me was at a hotel later. I got on the elevator, and there was a man, a woman, and a young girl on the elevator. And I looked, and it was Abe Vigoda.
Oh, my God.
And I said, I tried to resist, but I couldn't. Barney Miller was on at the time. I said, fish! And he just gave me this really pained, pained look. He didn't say a word.
Well, you know, I think if you're Abe Vigoda and you're in Omaha, you have to accept it. It's not like, you know, he's walking down Beverly Boulevard.
True. My guest is Julie Klemm. Her book is The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. Okay, let's hit some high points. Esther Newberg seems to be a very good source for you. Is she your agent?
Esther started her career working on the committee to elect Robert F. Kennedy for president.
Mm-hmm.
She was like very enmeshed in that world. She was in politics, and then she switched over to become an agent in the 70s. And, you know, the people that she has agented, I mean, she's Tom Hanks' book agent. She did the Prince memoir before he died. She was his agent. Plus, she's a head at ICM, a huge agency, so she knows all these other people. She's very, very well-connected and unimpressed with pretty much everybody. She had, like, this colleague that she had worked with who was he had been an agent for Fred Astaire and Steve McQueen and all these people, and she set it up for me to go and interview him, which was fantastic because there's somebody, he's still doing it, as Esther is still doing it, and they have seen how things have changed, so that is amazing. She also had an agent in her office who I had been talking to her about wanting to, you know, like, see how do you make a star? Is that even possible anymore? You know, in the old days, they sort of plucked people, supposedly, you know, would pluck an actress off out of, you know, Schwab's, and they would become a big star. You know, things are so different now. And she said, well, you know, we were talking about Christoph Waltz, who won 2 Academy Awards for Django Unchained and
that other movie.
That other, Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
See, when you talked to me back in 2010, my memory was much sharper. But anyway, so, and she said, his agent is here. And I went and met with his agent, that, like, went right downstairs and said, can I talk to you about how that went? And he said, oh, yeah, well, I had read the script for that movie, and I thought this Quentin Tarantino, it was the script for Inglourious Basterds, he said, I thought that that Quentin Tarantino wrote a part that was uncastable. This was a part of a person who needed to be able to act in 4 languages. Mm. And, you know, there is no person that like that that exists. But if he finds him, I am going to sign him. And that was what happened. He went from nobody to, and he wasn't, you know, he wasn't 22 either, to winning 2 Academy Awards and, you know, becoming a huge star. And you know, things like that were that. So that was part of the way I approached the book. Partly as a fan, and partly as a journalist, I guess.
Mm.
And sometimes they intersected. A lot of times they intersected.
Well, I'm intrigued by how, let's say you're on Twitter, and I'll admit I'm an old fogey. I go on Twitter, and I look at the stuff on there, and I see these people that have 500,000 followers, mm-hmm. and I never heard of them. You know,
right.
I don't know who these people are. It's just, it's mind-boggling. There's so many of them, and people can become instant celebrities, mm-hmm. and then you have people who become instant non-celebrities. And you mentioned one in your book who we actually had on this program in studio, a guy named Stephen Collins. Ooh,
right.
Boom, just gone. The career is gone.
Yeah, yeah.
It can happen that fast.
You know, it can happen. And it happens in a second, and I think things happen much faster with the internet than they used to, because things spread like wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody tweets something, you know, Paula Deen, and it doesn't take an hour before she's lost everything.
I think that's why it's so difficult right now, since we have a president who's governing through Twitter. Everything gets blown out of proportion so fast. Every 5 minutes, people are going crazy about all this hashtag garbage. It's just, it's insane. I kind of dip my toe in there, and then I immediately leave because I can't take it.
I know. I can't either. It's so painful. I mean, it's one thing when, you know, you see some, you know, former movie star having a breakdown on Twitter. It's another when you see the person, the leader of the free world, who's having a breakdown on Twitter.
Are you saying movie stars have breakdowns on Twitter?
Yes.
Really? I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
I missed that. I loved your anecdote about, I think you went to go interview R.A. Dickey when he was still pitching for the Mets. Is that the one where you forgot to turn?
He was on Toronto. It was his first year on Toronto.
Okay.
Is that
the one where you forgot to turn on your recorder?
I didn't forget. It was in my iPhone. I had this app. I don't know what happened, but when I left the interview, I pressed the play button, and it showed that it had recorded for 1 second. So you know that feeling where you're like, I'm going to throw myself out the window?
Yeah, I know the feeling. One time I got a chance to interview Peter Ustinov, the actor. He was in New York accepting an award. He'd flown in from Switzerland. He was at the hotel, is it the Pierre on Central Park? Mm-hmm. And I called him up, and he immediately launches into these incredible impersonations of like the Southern sheriff, and, you know, he's doing all these great voices.
Right, right.
And I look over, and I realize I haven't turned on the recorder.
Well, I mean, honestly, I think everybody who's a journalist, everybody who has done this kind of work has a story like that, because if I went after it, I mean, when it first happened, I couldn't tell anyone. It was like I could not. It was so sickening to me. I couldn't even mention it. And then once I sort of realized that, for some reason, because this interview was really important to me, I retained a lot of it. Also, I realized right away. So the minute it was over, I sat down and just wrote down everything that I could remember that he said.
Mm.
And the other thing is, like, a lot of the people I interviewed were people that would happily have sat down with me again. He was in the middle of baseball season, traveling, you know, every single day. He was in the middle of 160 games, really busy. So it wasn't like, I mean, I could go back to him with a question, but I wasn't going to be able to go back and go, oh, you know what, can we just do that again? So, and I have heard people who have done that. But it was so painful to me, and Esther set it up, because Esther is his literary agent. I couldn't tell her. I couldn't tell anyone. And then when I finally, you know, had the draft of the book and the story was in there, I tweeted something about it. And every journalist who follows me said, oh, my God, I had this with, you know, so-and-so, who then died. You know, it was like that kind of – I mean, everyone had a nightmare story, because technology – isn't perfect.
Well, I was impressed you were able to get an interview with him, because I guess maybe Esther opened the door. I tried to get an interview with him when he put out that memoir, which was around that same time, and they just said, yeah, right. He's a baseball player. He doesn't have time to talk to you.
Oh, that's crazy. Next time he has one, let me know. I'll have Esther set it up. He's absolutely, like, one of my favorite people I ever interviewed. He was so nice and so kind. Athletes. I mean, I've met a lot of movie stars and a lot of musicians. Athletes are something else, because I think, you know, if I had enough coaching, I might be able to act. I could never be like an opera singer, but I can carry a tune. I have no athletic ability at all. I mean, I'm very fit, and I do a lot of exercise, but I cannot catch a ball. I am terrible, and I bow down to people who really have that ability, because that is something that you can't, that you are just, you know, there's practice and everything, but you are either it or you're not. And he had this period in his career where he reinvented himself with the knuckleball, and he was very much, you know, I love old baseball. I love the turn of the century, the last century baseball. And, you know, I love the 20s and 30s baseball. And he reminds me of those kind of players, the people that, like, care about the fans and not being seen as, you know, a skirt chaser. You know, it was just like you felt like you were walking back in time talking to him.
You are listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. The Book Nook will continue right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. My guest today on the program is Julie Clamm, and her latest book is The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. I love that anecdote you had. I think it was from your friend Ann Leary, about how she was doing an interview with somebody who thought that she was married to somebody else.
Yeah, Dennis Miller.
That was hilarious.
Dennis Leary, and the person thought, and she said it happens to her quite a bit, and she just sort of goes along with it. And then in the same thing, she had was at a dinner, and she was sitting with this musician guy, and was offering to, if he had a cassette, she would pass it on, because her husband was Dennis Leary and he had friends in the music business, and it turned out to be Moby.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Anne is so hilarious and self-deprecating. But that happened, and she, you know, shared everything that made her look, you know, ridiculous, but hilarious.
And he's a vegetarian, and she helped him get a salad. She was, right. She's very nice to him.
Exactly.
I love that story. I can remember one time, you have a thing in here about people making big demands, people that have the contracts with the writers where they want their chicken with extra pepper on it.
Right.
And
yeah.
I was,
yeah. When I was, one of my first real jobs was I was a writer for the TV show Pop-Up Video.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where we wrote the sort of behind the scenes about things that happen in music videos. And the most fun thing to get was the artists' riders. This is what they request, you know, only, you know, brown jelly beans or, Oreos on a brown plate with a white doily, you know, every kooky kind of demand that they can make. And, you know, those were just always hilarious to see. And I found a bunch of them, and put those in the book because they just amuse me. How somebody can be like adamantly, I will take, you know, I must have fresh flowers and no carnations, you know.
So, mm-hmm. I'm guessing your brown jelly bean comment is an allusion to Van Halen.
Yeah, that was M&M's, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I worked for a caterer one time who was catering a Van Halen show when they were at the top of their game in Omaha.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave him the rider. They gave him the contract, and he had to go around and get all the stuff. And one thing they wanted was they wanted the brown M&Ms removed.
Right.
But they also had some other things on their contract that were interesting. They wanted an inflatable doll. And they said they wanted 3 dozen Coney Island whitefish.
Wow.
And my friend and I drove all over Des Moines wondering where to get Coney Island whitefish. We didn't know what that was.
Right.
And so we went around, and because we had to get the inflatable doll, we had to go into some kind of sketchy places. And we went in this XXX bookstore,
mm-hmm.
and there was an older lady at the counter smoking a cigarette. And
mm-hmm.
And we just thought, you know, we got the doll, and we thought, well, maybe she can help us. And we said, you know, we have this request for Coney Island whitefish. Do you have any idea what that means? And she kind of cackled, and she goes, I haven't heard that since the 30s. She said, you know, the only kind of fish that washes up on Coney Island? Condoms.
Oh, my God. I have never heard that. It's hilarious.
So we had 3 dozen Coney Island whitefish. And see, their whole thing was they'd go through the rider and they'd check everything off. And if you didn't have what they asked for, they'd go crazy.
Oh, yeah. All
yeah.
Right.
And so we passed the test.
That's hysterical. Wow. Now I'm going to start using that expression.
Now, I understand that you're working on another book. You alluded to it. Are you allowed to talk about it?
It's a historical memoir about my father had these 4 aunts that were very colorful characters who had a really interesting story. And when I decided that I wanted to look into writing about them, I realized that the stories that I'd heard my whole life about them were, once I looked up actual researching the documents, the story was all different. And, you know, so the book is about their story and my searching through their story, and also just about how families pass down stories that change because of people feel ashamed of things that happened, and so they rewrite their history. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, certainly back then no one had any idea that, you know, there'd be an internet where you could look up their birth certificate or their, you know, their travel papers or their census where they lived or who they said was alive or dead. And it has turned into just this remarkable you know, journey for me. I went to Romania, where they had come from, and St. Louis. Yep. They lived in St. Louis when they were kids, and I went there, went to the St. Louis insane, that was the lunatic asylum that one of their family members was in, and to the orphanage where they were. And, you know, I've been sort of like going to all of these places and doing research and finding a lot of things online. And I'm absolutely loving writing this. It's due in January, and I'm going to be very sad when it's over. But it is really, really fun to do.
You're serious? It sounds like you're almost finished.
Well,
sort of.
I'm going to be finished in time, but yeah.
You're gonna have to crawl in your cave for the next 3 months. It sounds like.
I always sort of like do a lot of thinking and working on things, and then I sit down and write the whole thing in 3 months or, you know, 2 months or whatever. And I have written a lot of this one along the way, not in order, but as I'm going, because, you know, sort of how I go. But yeah, I know.
Yeah. Well, that's very cool.
So you won't wait as long between books again.
That's exciting. That sounds like a great project. And we did hear one of your beloved animal companions barking or making a little noise in the background. And I don't want to neglect to mention that Julie wrote the best book on dogs ever written. It's called You Had Me at Woof.
Thank you. Yeah.
That is the greatest book. How many dogs do you have now?
At the moment, I just have two, because if I have two dogs, I can still foster one. If I have more than two dogs, then it becomes impossible to bring in another dog. Mm. So I have these two, and I still foster the occasional. We've had a few this year, but I really like to have like these little visitors come through and then leave.
Right. Well, let's talk about this advocacy that you have. There's a particular type of dog that you really like to work with.
Boston Terriers, because I was always attracted to them even before I knew what the breed was. They're a very funny dog. They look sort of like little old men. They're in a lot of cartoons from the 30s. In fact, Betty Boops had a Boston Terrier named Bimbo. And I just always liked them. I would see them on the street, and I finally asked a person what the breed was, and then I sort of had it in my head that I was going to get a Boston Terrier if I ever got a dog. And then, you know, it was a long time ago before rescue was like a thing, but I happened to get a rescue Boston Terrier because I had called a breeder and she did rescue, and she had this dog, and he became, you know, the love of my life, Otto. What I found with breed rescue is that, because people are like, oh, well, you should be rescuing whatever dog needs rescuing. But if you know a lot about a particular dog, it's helpful to do that, because there are people who are looking for a specific kind of dog. They're not going to take any kind of dog, and you can help them find the one they want without having to go to a breeder or, you know, wait for puppies to be born. And you get to, you know their personalities enough to realize this dog, how they are. If they're, you can see that they're not good with kids, or that they would do best in as the only dog, or they really don't like to be left alone, or whatever the thing is. So I started doing that. And of course, you know, I mean, my two dogs that I have now are mixes, because Boston Terriers don't necessarily, when they're out on the streets, don't necessarily know to meet with other Boston Terriers.
Okay.
So.
All right. But they still look like Bostons?
They have the Boston coloring, but they have long noses.
And they're wonderful, aren't they?
They're so great. I've had them since they were born, and they're going to be 9 next week.
Wow.
I know. Nuts.
That's great. Well, Julie, it's always great to talk to you, and I'm wondering. We had Lon Wainwright III on, the singer, the other day, and he has a memoir out. And in the memoir and in the interview, he talked about how when he was in grade school and he was living in Los Angeles, one of his playmates was Judy Garland's daughter, Liza Minnelli.
Oh,
and
my God.
They used to play together. And I was wondering, do you have anybody from your childhood that went on to become a celebrity? And if so,
Stanley,
do you?
Stanley Tucci. I went to school with Stanley Tucci. And Campbell Scott, who is the son of George C. Scott and Colleen Dewhurst, who is an actor also. Both of them were in my high school.
Wow.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's pretty good, right?
That's pretty good. Well, when you were talking about Esther Newberg, I thought, I know a guy who's a high-powered agent, and I haven't seen him since he was 3 years old, but his parents were my godparents.
Oh, wow.
And so I Googled him. His name is Patrick Weitzel.
Uh-huh.
You ever heard of him?
Yep. Uh-huh.
He's the co-CEO at William Morris. He represents like Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman and Denzel Washington and Kate Hudson and Matt Damon and all. Big names.
Mm-hmm.
You know they're big names when you Google them and it says the name and then it says net worth. Next to him. You know, that's the Google search term that comes up first.
Yeah,
And so,
which, by the way, is a complete lie. Those are, knowing several celebrities who are in that thing, they said there's nothing even remotely close to what they actually have. So don't ever believe it.
Well, we used to go up to their house in Iowa Falls, Iowa, and I was wondering, how did this Patrick Weitzel become such a hotshot in Hollywood? And I looked him up on Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
And he had three brothers who I remember as little kids.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Sean Weitzel, who became known for his portrayal of cannibalistic inmate Donald Groves, the initial cellmate of Miguel Alvarez in HBO's Oz.
Right.
He died a couple years ago. He has another brother named John Weitzel, who's a television and movie director, and another brother named Christopher, who has been writing for soap operas like Days of Our Lives and General Hospital. It's like, how did four brothers from Iowa Falls, Iowa, become big shots in Hollywood? I don't get it.
That would be a good question for him. They all obviously wanted to get out of Iowa. Did you know that my boyfriend's from Iowa?
Isn't he from Creston?
Yeah, he is.
And you've never been to Dyersville. You know, I've been to the Field of Dreams.
I know.
You'd probably like it.
I know. We keep talking. And I also want to go to Laura Ingalls Wilder's house. That's up in northern Iowa, but it's so far away from where his family is. It's like we're not going to take a separate vacation to a different part of Iowa. Highly unlikely, but you know, maybe one day.
Well,
or maybe I'll break up with him and then date somebody who's from that part of Iowa.
You're hilarious. I'm amazed you're dating a guy from Iowa. Period.
Yes, he's the love of my life.
Well, that's good.
I know. I'm very lucky.
That's wonderful. And you mentioned Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
You know, that really brought back a memory for me because are you familiar with the doppelganger thing where,
mm-hmm.
you know how people look like somebody else? Well, people used to come up to me and they'd say, oh, you look just like Philip Seymour Hoffman.
That is funny.
And I got really tired of it. And so I hate to say this, but when he died, I almost felt a sense of relief.
That thing is very funny. People, there's a guy who lives right near my gym. I see him almost every day, and he looks so much like Alec Baldwin that I think he is starting to act like he's somebody famous, because whenever I look at him, he looks like, oh, yeah, no, I know what you're thinking, and it's not true.
It is Alec Baldwin, though, right?
He's not Alec Baldwin.
Oh, okay. I'm just teasing you.
Hi.
Hello? I just heard somebody say hi. You got somebody come?
My phone just decided to talk to you.
Your iPhone?
Yeah, my iPhone is possessed. I'm going to turn it off.
Okay. Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Julie.
Thank you so much, Vic, and I look forward to whatever the next one is.
Julie Clam has been my guest in the Book Nook today. Her book is The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. And as I mentioned during the interview, Julie has written the greatest book about dogs that I have ever read. And if you're into dogs and you haven't discovered this book, you might want to check it out. It's called You Had Me at Woof: How Dogs Taught Me the Secrets of Happiness. And I want to read you an excerpt from You Had Me at Woof, just to give you a flavor of the way it's written and her sense of humor. Julia is very involved in rescuing Boston Terriers. She has a real soft spot for these little dogs, and she spends a lot of time trying to help get them adopted. This is from You Had Me at Woof. After that, Paul and I agreed that our family was not up to the job of fostering dogs. We couldn't take that kind of risk. There were still many ways I could help the rescue organization, and before long I was assigned my first home check, then my second, then my third, and so on. Pretty much everyone who wanted to adopt a Boston Terrier in Manhattan lived in a fifth-floor walk-up, or so it seemed to me. I would arrive at these apartments breathless and say, you do know, huffing and puffing, that Boston Terrier's legs, gag, are very, very short, catching breath, don't you? I didn't discount them for that unless they were looking to adopt a senior dog, in which case I still didn't want to reject them. It's a very unique position, sizing up someone to possibly adopt one of our guys. As I'd ride the subway to 135th Street or St. Mark's Place, I'd think about the process adoptive parents go through before being allowed to adopt a child. While the people who got pregnant themselves were under no such scrutiny, in the case of our Bostons, we were the guardians, and they were our charges. We couldn't be responsible for backyard breeders or pet shop sellers not investigating the homes, but we could do it, and at least we knew we were placing our rescues in homes where we'd be comfortable placing our own dogs. Most people tried very hard. You could see they'd cleaned up, and they listened carefully to questions. One woman opened the door, never looking at me, and led me to the living room where she kept her eyes glued to the Animal Planet channel. It wasn't an act to show me she was an animal lover. She was just very weird. But a lot of excellent pet owners were not necessarily people I wanted to hang out with. I sort of like to think of myself as a moderate between the crazy animal people and the people who saw pets as disposable. The home checks I did in the city were vastly different from the ones in rural areas because New York apartments generally didn't have fenced-in yards. Many people who look to rescue a dog have had one before and know what it involves, and they're attracted to a breed for a reason. As an apartment dweller with Boston Terriers, I had a lot of insight to offer and could highly recommend them as city dogs. I felt particularly connected to the applicants who'd seen a dog on our website and were applying for them. Many times a photo that gets to someone triggers something. It's like the way I want to take every dog whose eyes are bulgy and go in different directions. My cousin Mandy, who is a veterinary technician and has worked in many shelters, cautions against picking a dog who looks like a dog who has died because, of course, it's not that dog, and she feels like the owners can become disappointed when they see that. Her mother had a beloved English bulldog who passed away and was followed by another one who looked like the first one but was not. She actually hated the new one, and true to her prediction, it outlived her. But having taken Beatrice on the heels of Otto, and knowing they were nothing alike, and still being okay about it, I wasn't so sure. I definitely agreed with keeping expectations realistic. I also knew people who would get the same breed of dog over and over and keep naming them the same thing. Sparky 1, Sparky 2, Sparky 3, and it didn't seem to bother them, though I can't speak for the Sparkies. I'd been busy with work and not paying as much attention to the lists as normal when I got a call on my cell phone while I was at the gym. It was about 95 degrees outside, and I had to draw off repeatedly to hear the message. It was Cheryl, and she said it was urgent. I called her back, and she boiled down the story. There was a woman with a found Boston in the West Village who was going to dump the dog in the city pound if someone didn't get him today. And that was an excerpt from Julie Clam's You Had Me at Woof, How Dogs Taught Me the Secrets of Happiness, my favorite dog book. You've been listening to Book Nook on WYSO. Julie's current book is The Stars in Our Eyes. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in.